Well, hello everyone and welcome. I have a guest here today. It is Mike from Imperium Press, back again. Fantastic publisher of many, many great books, including, of course, my own best-selling Populist Delusion. Buy it now. And of course, Applied Elite Theory, which even more people should buy now. But other than those, there are also many, many other great books, past and present, in the Imperium Press catalogue. So it's always a privilege to have Mike here. He's a serious thinker in his own right as well. How are you doing, Mike?
Yeah, I'm doing very well, actually. It's I know it's getting warmer where you are, but it's getting cooler where I am down in Australia. And I love it. This is my favorite time of year, actually.
So recently here in the UK, the question of nationalism has come up again, okay? And I have a buddy, famous guy, Carl Benjamin, who basically started trending on Twitter a while back after this reply. Let me just share this reply, Mike, because you have a book on nationalism. It's kind of a fair-minded look at what nationalism is, what its good points are, and maybe what its bad points are as well, from, broadly speaking, a folkish perspective. But let me just give you what Carl Benjamin said and see if we can use this as a jumping-off point for talking about nationalism. So this actually trended on Twitter, and in fact, he was roundly harangued by many, many nationalists for this post. So this was actually this guy, Wolf, who started off as a big Rupert Lowe fan, as a big kind of Restore fan on Twitter. But over time, he has become more critical. And this is a little clip of Rupert Lowe talking about how legal immigration is more difficult and contrary to what Farage said, blah, blah, blah. And then basically at one point, Lowe says in the interview, well, the thing is, he's a true Tory, okay? And this was then used to attack him, you know, as being like a covert conservative or something like a member of the Conservative Party. And Carl just came straight in with this reply here, and you'll see why it's relevant in a second. He says, Jesus Christ, man, knock this nonsense off. The true Tory is the most right-wing perspective of duty and patricianship that England can produce. Quote-unquote nationalism is continental bullshit, and you are bewitched by ephemeral words rather than realizing that we have our own homegrown nativist leader here. He is for us. The language he uses is imperfect, but the essence is true. Okay? Now, let's subtract the, you know, parochial everyday politics and us of Rupert Lowe and the rest of it. What that led to on Twitter that day, and in fact that week, was Carl batting off many, many attacks coming from, you know, broadly speaking, nationalists all around the world, and him saying, sticking to his guns, basically, and saying, like, actually, nationalism is a late continental post-French Revolution development, and really, our heart should be somewhere else. So as a starting point, Mike, how do you respond to this kind of thing, this talking point that does the rounds once in a while, here by Carl Benjamin?
Right. Well, I mean, Carl's absolutely right that nationalism is something that comes a bit later in the historical record. Now, this is something that I've shifted on over time a little bit. One of the few things that I've kind of changed my mind on since I wrote my book, The Culture Thug Handbook, a couple of years ago, where I basically said that nationalism is something that's ancient. And there's a yes and no. I don't want to get too nuanced about it, but basically the nation is something that is deeply ancient, but nationalism is something that is kind of modern, actually. It's not that people didn't identify with the nation earlier. It's that nationalism as a doctrine comes in, yes, as a result of modernity. So nationalism, I think we have to kind of talk about what it is to understand why Carl's right here. Nationalism is more than just loving your people. It is actually the elevation of the nation to the primary political identity. Now, there are a lot of identities that we have. You know, one of them is my family. Another one is, you know, being a member of my locality or living in my neighborhood. And in earlier times, not that long ago, actually, for certain peoples in the British Isles, we had things like clans or tribes and folkhoods. Like, we still have folkhoods. People can be Wessex men or Northumbrians or, you know, Cornish, that sort of thing. What nationalism says, the part in it that's new, is that you, as a Cornishman, need to subordinate that identity to being English specifically, right? Now, I think Carl probably means this in the sense of British identity, because I know he identifies pretty strongly as an Englishman, also as a British person, but his English identity is a bit stronger, I think. I don't want to put words in his mouth. But this idea that, like, nationalism elevates the nation to being the central object of political loyalty over and above all of the other smaller loyalty, that is new. That's something that was basically unintelligible throughout most of human history until the modern era. So, yeah, I think that in it is actually quite new, and it could not really happen. It was structurally something that couldn't really exist until the modern era. Like, you know, it was very difficult to achieve that under, say, feudal conditions, for example. So that is the sense in which nationalism is something new.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this from a slightly different perspective the other day, when it just kind of came up when I was reviewing a conversation between David Starkey and Tommy Robinson, right? During the course of that conversation, they accused Keir Starmer, who's the Prime Minister of the UK, of being a globalist who wants to destroy Britain. And I thought, during the course of that, so is this actually a fair characterization of a character like Starmer? Because it feels to me, and I'm not the only person who said this, Morgoth made a video along the same lines recently as well, that a figure like Keir Starmer is actually just the embodiment of the British state as it stands. And from a strange perspective, Keir Starmer exists for whatever it is the British state has become. And he is almost like the perfect instrument of this state. The law as it stands right now is almost like a kind of sacred duty to him, okay? Yet, it would feel very odd to call Keir Starmer a nationalist, right? Because Keir Starmer obviously has no love for the people of Britain. Keir Starmer has no love, it seems, for anything apart from the full force of the law and the state as it is and the institution which must be protected at all costs. So I'm wondering if we can use a figure, a weird modern figure like Keir Starmer, to tease out a little bit, right? Because I think you'd agree with me, Mike, that Starmer's not really a nationalist, despite the fact that he's so closely identified with the British state. Or is he a nationalist? This is a genuine question.
Well, I don't think he's nationalist, because he has explicitly said, famously, that he identifies more with Davos than with Westminster. So I don't think we can call him a nationalist, but there are people certainly in his orbit that might be called civic nationalists. Now, before we go down the route of explaining civic nationalism, I think we need to make a distinction between the nation and the state, because the nation, and this is how I define it in the book, is a historically continuous, self-recognizing human collectivity. It's a people, basically. And the state is an apparatus of rule. So it's a structure that administers, it gives law, it wields coercion, and so on and so forth. So the nation is, and this is another formulation from the book, the nation is the thing, and the state is the instrument used to govern that thing. Keir Starmer is loyal to the state, but he's not loyal to the nation. So, and I mean, it's important to make this distinction. because nations can exist without states, right? You could think of the Jewish people historically, or Kurdish people, and so on and so forth. And states can preside over nations that, or over more than one nation, right? You might think of an empire, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so on and so forth. So actually, Keir Starmer is very useful here, because he illustrates this distinction very clearly, because he obviously is he has no loyalty. He's loyalty to institutions. He's loyalty to an administration. And perhaps we could say a constitutional order, although, yeah, it's complicated because the English Constitution's unwritten. But he basically is kind of speaking the language of the state rather than the language of nationalism. So he's very state-centric. He tends to treat Britain more as a kind of administrative society than as an organic people. And so that, I think that's where he makes that the distinction, basically. And we might get into this dichotomy a little bit later. He is loyal to thin identities, but he's very disloyal to thick identities. He kind of seems to distrust them. And so does the, you know, globalist, the elites, basically. They see thick identities as suspect and morally questionable and possibly dangerous. And, well, definitely they see them as dangerous. So that's where he kind of sits in there. I would not characterize him as a nationalist.
Yeah, that's I think that's a good way. I thought Starmer might be an interesting figure to try to encapsulate exactly what we're talking about here. So given that, so you're starting to make nationalism sound quite good in a way, with this kind of thick kind of characterization, you might want to put it, or, you know, and for the reasons that Starmer wouldn't like it. Okay. A lot of people may be thinking, well, those sound like good things, right? And not just because he doesn't like them. But when I was talking to you before the stream, you said, well, actually, you have some, you know, you have some, I guess, nuances that you want to put around this. And this will bring us back round to Carl Benjamin's critique of nationalism as well. What is the issue with nationalism, Mike, if it becomes the top level identity? Like, what is the fundamental problem here?
So, I mean, nationalism is actually quite attractive. And for a long time, I called myself a nationalist. I don't anymore, actually. Because it is attractive, though, because it really solves real problems, right? It's good at bringing a large number of people under a single polity, right? It reduces factionalism. It's able to act at an international scale. Basically, what nationalism does is it promotes national unity and organization at scale, which is obviously very, very adaptive in a geopolitical environment. Like when you have effectively an anarchic system with power vacuums and you have to act in your own interest or make alliances with others who can. The nation's very useful there. This is a Mearsheimer point. So that's what's good about it. But there's a trade-off. National unity, the stronger it gets, the more it tends to undermine the pre-political social capital that underlies the nation. And I think those are points, those are terms that might bear some definition at some point, but I'll just make the point first. When it tries to stand above the lower identities that I mentioned before, like family, clan, tribe, folk, and so on, it begins as something that doesn't compete with those, but then it ends up actually trying to undermine them and compete with them because they command loyalty much more naturally than the nation actually does. Most of us are more loyal to our locality, certainly to our family, than we are to the nation. But the nation asks us to put that aside, right? Like if your brother, say, for example, was to commit a crime, it would be expected, like polite society expects that you would turn him in and that you wouldn't hide him, or, you know what I mean? Like, you'd put the good of the nation before the good of your own family. And this is quite reasonable, right? Like, it makes sense and it's intuitive and everything. It's intuitive because this is what we've lived under for centuries. But the fact is that people are more loyal to their family. They are more loyal to their locality. They are more loyal to all of these smaller, more close pre-political identities. And so what the nation has to do is it uses a number of different means to make the identity of the nation stronger than any of those. Some of them are, you know, symbolic means, things like national anthems, flags, and you know, even things like myths and legends and founding stories, and you know, people like pointing to heroes like King Alfred or George Washington and things like that. It uses these symbolic means, but it also is not afraid to revert to coercive means, basically to put these lower level identities in their place, because they are basically Juvenalian rival castles. Anybody who's read The Populist Delusion will understand what that means. They're basically these intermediary structures that the system depends upon, but are always sort of threatening to overtake the larger system. The nation kind of has to spend the social capital that these lower level identities produces in order to keep them in check. So nationalism seems, you could put it this way. There's like a reservoir of social capital, which in a very rough sense is something like trust. There's a reservoir of this social capital that arises organically just by the way that these smaller identities operate. What nationalism does is it draws from that reservoir and says, you should treat the nation like a family. But nationalism doesn't actually replenish those that reservoir over time. In a healthy state, it does, or it tries at least not to draw from the reservoir too unsustainably. But over time, it seems to be inevitable that it will actually do that, that it will weaken, say, the family identity, which is, you know, we see what's happened with the denigration of the family father, the denigration of the family, antinatalism, all of these things. The system seems to be pretty anti-family. I think most people can agree with that. And part of that is just basically this Juvenalian mechanism of trying to tamp down on anything that could possibly challenge it. So over time, the nation tends to undermine these lower level structures, but because the nation depends upon things like family feeling or, you know, clan or ethnic solidarity, at least analogously, for it to hold together, over time, essentially, it's kind of sawing away at the branch that it's sitting on. It's undermining its own foundation. And I think that this helps to explain where we are today and why, although on one hand, nationalism seems to be enjoying a resurgence. On the other hand, things seem to be moving in a bit of a more tribal direction, which is something that we talked about in an earlier interview. So I think nationalism is, it seems to be coming back, but it's also much more fragile than it ever was. So it's a bit of an unstable situation.
You know, it would be remiss of me not to mention, you know, as a Welshman, Mike, right? I have to mention the fact that there are real historical examples of the bigger nationalism trampling on smaller identities. In the case of Wales, okay, and I'm not doing this in some kind of like performative Welsh nationalist thing, or to, you know, this is like just a historical fact. The English and the British state at various times in history went as far as to ban and to punish Welsh, the language of Welsh. The language of Welsh was basically resurrected in over the past 100 years. It was resurrected after being actively oppressed. In France, Napoleon literally went around on horseback and sword, trampling on the smaller regional French identities and dialects, bringing it all under one banner of, you know, this is going to be the French now. So these things actually happened as a historical fact. So there you can see like nationalism being used in a way to trample on local, what you'd call local identities. So that is something that I think is worth bearing in mind. You can also see when nationalism became a real thing, various theorists and political figures grappling with these problems when they basically create national myths. In the case of Italy, this was a problem because Italy, the history of Italy is the history of city-states and also very much the history of the North versus the South. So I think the guy's name was Mazzini. He basically had to be like, well, what's a unified national story that we can tell ourselves that's not too centered on Rome, that doesn't privilege the North over the South? And, you know, this is something that Mussolini had to kind of contend with as well. In the case of India, obviously India is a massive, massive country. Gandhi literally had to sit down and be like, what are the unifying national things that we can call Indian, where it's not just like Punjab or not just, you know, this area or that area? And in that case, they've got tons of ethnicities, tons of languages, tons of different religions. So, you know, Gandhi had a pretty difficult task ahead of him. But Indian nationalism remains a thing today. Currently, India has a nationalist leader called Modi. But these are all kind of genuine, serious questions that I think a lot of nationalists don't consider or don't take seriously enough.
Yeah, I agree. And this is part of why, you know, we wanted to put out this book. The book in question is just called Nationalism, and it's part of a new series that we're calling Fundamentals, which is basically introductions to different topics. So on the one hand, the book is intended to take nationalism seriously, to give it a fair hearing, and to explain why it actually works, and not just as a sort of lamentation about that it's bigoted or primitive or anything like that. But on the other hand, taking it seriously means looking at it for what it is, and doing, as you say, a value-free analysis of nationalism. And there are some serious issues with it, right? Because basically, the overall problem, there's a number of trade-offs, but the main trade-off that I wanted to talk about today is the trade-off between scale and cohesion, essentially. Because, you know, nationalists often, you know, a lot of people sort of in the, you know, in the right wing sphere, shall we say, people who would be in favor of restore or maybe even just reform, they see the nation as essentially kind of like as a people, right? As in the way that I've already laid out. And that is the right way to see it. But when you see the nation as an organic people, then we have to ask ourselves how it actually holds together. Like, what is the glue? What is the force that actually holds it together? And really, what the nation does in order to hold like millions of people together is it does it by extending, it scales kinship, basically, right? Because for there to be millions upon millions of people, I forget how many people, what the population of Great Britain is right now, what, somewhere like 50 million people or something, 70 million it's people, whatever.
More like 80, probably.
80 million people.
70 or 80, yeah.
That's a lot of strangers to have inside of your core identity. Like, that's a lot of people to say us about, right? So the nation has to solve a problem. And the problem is that people can only really hold about 100 to 300 personal relationships in their head at once. So what it needs to do is it needs to actually scale these smaller loyalties into symbolic and institutional forms. I gave some examples of symbolic forms before, flags, national anthems, this sort of thing, right?
Sorry to interrupt, Mike, but because I know what commenters are like, I should qualify what I just said. When I said 70 to 80, the official stats are about 68, okay? But friends of mine have done analysis on sewage pipes and things like that, suggesting that there's probably about 10 million extra people in the country if you look at the electricity grid, sewage, etc. So that's where my figure's coming from, just to be clear. Otherwise, all the comments will be, you know, he doesn't know how many people there are in the country. Anyway, go on, carry on.
Yeah, but however many people there are, it's way too many to hold in your head all at once. So the nation has to sort of borrow the emotional force of family, basically. And it has to, in order to basically, in order to make this relatively thin identity, and I know people are going to get mad about me calling national identity thin, but certainly compared to familial identity, compared to like extended family identity, all these things, it is quite thin, you know, by comparison. Mm-hmm. Certainly thicker than racial identity, thicker than the species level identity or whatever it is. These things are on a scale, right? So it basically, and maybe we should talk about that first. Maybe we should talk about what's meant by thick identity and thin identity.
I want to get into that, Mike. I also want to get into a few other topics as well after my break here, because this is one of the things that I've been going on about for years, actually, is the relative thinness of, you know, British national identity. I call it biscuit tin traditionalism, right? Morgoth also coined the term bulldog nationalism as well, where, you know, in this country, there's a set of markers, and it's like, you know, a tin of shortbread biscuits with the Queen's face on it, you know what I mean? And it's like, so I want to get into exactly what these thin or thick markers are in a second, and some of the potential problems with them. I also want to talk about the issue from the other end, the empire part, which is one of the reasons I have never at any point, despite what lies you might read about me, ever said I'm a nationalist, because I, you know, I've always seen all of these things from both ends, from the super local point of view and from the just the power imperial point of view as well. But we'll get into both of those topics and much more. But first, I must remind people that I have a sale on at the moment at the academic agency. It's 25% off all courses. Promo code COOL. Watch this ad and then we'll just come back straight away. Everybody wants to be cool. Like this guy. This guy is cool. Do you know who else is cool? People who do courses at the academic agency. And you too can be cool by getting a course today with promo code COOL, which gets you 25% off all courses today. Promo code COOL. That's how Mike is hanging out right now in his funky jacket. Just before we get going, Mike, where can people buy this book? We should mention that.
You can get this at imperiumpress.org. It was released a couple of weeks ago, but by Imperium standards, it is now it's not one of the featured releases because we've had like three since then. So we just are going at an absolutely insane pace. But if you click on the titles, you'll find it. It's just called Nationalism, and it's part of the Fundamentals series.
I'll put a link down in the notes here. Okay, so let's get back to the question of thin and thick identity, because over the years, and I've been kind of involved, in online politics in general for about a decade at this point. So I've seen many cycles come and go. I've seen all the different, you know, I've been able to map all the different factions of all the different sides, the right and the left, and all the douchebags in between. And, you know, over the years, my least favorite kind of creature has been what I generally call the Tory boy, okay? And there are all sorts of kind of cultural and national markers that they cling to. It's, I mean, okay, you can picture your tin of Scottish shortbread with the Queen's face on it. Maybe you've got, you know, Winston Churchill, right? Winston Churchill's another one with his big cigar. Maybe they'll be like the symbol of the lion with a flag over his face. What else do they point to? But, you know, and then, you know, they share them in really quite boomerific, you know, quite a kind of boomerific manner. And all I can think of when I look at these is like literally everything that you're doing is just furthering liberal hegemony, right? Every single aspect of this constructed identity is just used to sell the brand of UK PLC. And it is not actually getting to the root of what it means to be British. And of course, part of it segues into this notion that anybody, regardless of where they come from in the world, can simply become British just by, for example, having high tea and playing cricket. Right? But we know, and you know, and everybody watching this knows, that no amount of, you know, drinking tea and eating Victoria Sponge and watching Paddington Bear and playing cricket is going to turn, I don't know, like a Somalian into an English gentleman, right? So how do we navigate this? So how do you, like, is there more to it? Am I selling national identity short by you know, pointing to these derisive things? Because when it actually manifests in real life or on Twitter or on social media or in a Tommy Robinson march or something, it's all this bullshit all the time. It's always the same symbols. Mike, take it away.
Yeah, well, I think the main distinction here to be made between what we might call like a valid British identity versus something that's relatively superficial is that the valid British identities tend to be something that's inherited, whereas the superficial identities tend to be something more portable, right? So for example, we, you know, as, and in a way, I consider myself maybe spiritually British, being Canadian and part of the Commonwealth, which is something that I actually take seriously. You know, my Canadian national identity is historically essentially loyalism to the British Empire. That's what it means to be a Canadian conservative. I mean, that wouldn't be what, you know, Pierre Poilievre would not agree with that today, the head of the Conservative Party in Canada, but that is historically what it means. So anyway, I feel like I can maybe speak a little bit on British identity for that reason. But the real, like, thick British identity is something that's inherited and historical. It's something that you can't step in and out of. You couldn't leave it if you tried, you know, pointing to something like the consolidation of the British people under the Anglo-Saxons and in the early, you know, medieval era. That would be something that's an important part of British identity. Beowulf is an important part of British identity. King Alfred is an important part of British identity. The Arthurian cycle is something that's important to British identity. That's something that we share as peoples who are part of this sort of collective endeavor. Of course, a collective endeavor can absorb peoples over time, and it has to it. They're not the whole part of it. And what tends to happen is the, you know, the Tommy Robinsons and the Tory boys and the, you know, Americans would say conservatives tend to focus on these portable identities more than the essential identities. So I'm talking about things like beliefs. You know, as a British person, you know, we believe in freedom. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in X, Y, and Z. And that's all wonderful. But there, if that is what it means to be a British person, then at the end of the day, there is no reason to distinguish Great Britain from America, because America believes in those things too. There's no reason to distinguish it from South Korea, because South Korea is liberal and believes in the rule of law as well. So there must be something thicker that is more inherited and embodied and particular. So, we're engaged in this historical project that is the nation. Now, I think this is important because some nationalists will tend to view the nation as something that's more too static, something that never changes and is just primordially has been the same since the beginning of time. And I don't think that's good, because things that are static tend to be dead. There has to be a dynamism where the nation can change while retaining its essential character, basically. But in order to do that, it has to be part of this historical project. And it's not something that you can just kind of believe your way into, or I mean, it is a set of customs. Being British is in many ways very customary, but that's not all it is. And people who are more like on the civic nationalist end of things tend to look at those things and say, that's actually all that it is. And that's a huge mistake. And that's why, something like Storr has been popular.
This is quite a tricky area, because let me try to like make this more concrete. Let me give you an example of a tweet that I saw the other day. Can't remember who this was, but it was, one of the reasonably big kind of British right accounts. I think it was a guy called UKIPper, who's got like a Nigel Farage avatar, like eating a sandwich or something like that. And he put up a picture of a bag of fish and chips. Okay. Bag of fish and chips in a newspaper. Okay. And he just said, this is my politics. Right. And it was like a picture of some fish and chips. Okay. Now, here's the thing. The fish and chips obviously does not have the long history of going back to King Alfred. In fact, I think it was brought over in the 19th century, possibly, don't quote me on this, but possibly by the Jewish community in North London. I could be wrong about that, but I've got it in the back of my mind that it came in the 19th century and it was brought over by a group like that. Okay. However, it is also true that anybody who grew up in this country will know what he's talking about, because it is embodied and it is something that everybody does. And it's something that people in this country do that they don't do, for example, in Spain or in France or in Germany or elsewhere. Okay, so there is a part, there's like, you see that image and you know what he's talking about. But at the same time, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, this is not like the long history going back to King Alfred. So how do you deal with that? Like, this is like a typical thing that you'd see on, British right Twitter on any given day. So how do you pass that image? How do you pass that tweet? This is my politics, the bag and fish and chips.
Well, on the one hand, it's kind of doing something good. Like I can endorse it in a qualified way, right? Because what it's not doing is it's not affirming a proposition, right? It's not saying, diversity is our strength, or even something like, the rule of law is, affirming the rule of law, right? It's not affirming something that can be true or false, which is the weakest and thinnest kind of identity, really, because by definition, anybody can affirm anything as being true or false, right? Like, truth is something that is universal inherently. So there's not much of an identity to be built upon affirming propositions. So that's good. I like that. But also at the same time, it's affirming something that is very abstract, something that is a little bit far away from the ground, for what I would prefer, right? And I think here, to understand what's going on here, we need to introduce another distinction, and this is between civic nationalism, ethnic nationalism, and cultural nationalism, which is kind of a continuum, really. They're really positions on a spectrum of abstraction. So civic nationalism is the most abstract, and cultural less so, and ethnic nationalism almost entirely not abstract, right? So And by abstraction, what I mean is how closely does it map onto the pre-political identities beneath the nation that we talked about in the beginning, right? Ethnic nationalism very much maps onto those identities. And as a result, it's the least likely to undermine the social capital that those identities build up. Cultural nationalism is kind of a middle form between that and civic nationalism, and it defines the nation mainly through things like traditions or customs, like eating fish and chips. Maybe it might define it linguistically. Maybe it might define it in terms of like a shared history or symbols or literature and everything. When I say that, you know, the Arthurian cycle is really close to the root of British identity, well, it is. It's closer, but it's not right down at the bedrock, right? This is cultural nationalism. And of course, beyond that, in terms of abstraction, we have civic nationalism, which basically detaches the nation from the pre-political identities that make nations have like thick identity, right? It's what Keir Starmer would endorse if he would endorse nationalism of any kind. Cultural nationalism sits in the middle of that. And this seems to be, this tweet is an expression of that. It's an expression of this cultural nationalism, which is actually, there's a strength to this cultural nationalism because it can kind of, first of all, it can integrate somewhat broader populations, which is part of the reason why English identity was able to grow out and eventually consolidate Scottish identity, Irish, Northern Irish identity, Welsh identity, and so on and so forth. Right? Through a shared culture. And now obviously there's a familial relationship between the British peoples as well, but it was mainly done in terms of culture, in terms of religion and other things like that. So it's very strong, but it depends on culture being thick and authoritative, especially. If the culture deteriorates to being too thin or like aesthetic, like eating fish and chips or consumerist or something that you can step out of, then cultural nationalism tends to kind of weaken. It becomes this sort of museum nationalism, right? Or like a food truck nationalism, where all you have in common with your folk are that you eat the same food, you speak the same language, and all of these things. Now, shared like cuisine, we've done, me and my podcast partner, Dave Martell on Culture Dads, we've done several episodes on the importance of cuisine to cultural identity, to being folk, being part of a certain folk. It's important, but that's not all of it, right? And cultural nationalism can decay into civic nationalism pretty easily when it focuses only on those cultural trappings and not upon the sort of substrate that lies underneath all of it.
So one thing, I mean, this interview that we're doing will probably go out on May bank holiday here in Britain. But we also have there's two bank holidays in May. There's tons of, like, it kind of drives me, as a dad, it drives me up the wall because it's two days off school, the little one.
Yeah, I know the point.
Another day off. But the first one is May Day, which is an ancient festival, okay? One of the oldest customs in the country is going around the Maypole. And I thought it would be really nice to take my family to a place called Hever Castle and for my little one to do the Maypole. And we did it. And it was a lovely day, really nice thing. And I've talked about this on other shows as well. But as I was watching the Maypole, and they had actors there who were kind of, kind of hamming it up for the kids and all that sort of stuff. But you know, they had a king of the spring and a king of the summer and a king of the autumn and a king of the winter. And they did the Maypole. They did it in the traditional manner. But as I was watching it play out with, you know, all of the parents with their phones out, taking pictures of the kids and, you know, some bloke was there in his tracksuit. And, you know, I was thinking some part of this is not living. This is, you know, you mentioned the phrase museum. This is not the embodiment of a living tradition. This is like some modern people doing it because it feels nice or something like that. But it didn't feel like there was some part of me that was like, this is not authentic. Okay. And this is where it gets difficult, Mike, because there's some part of that fish and chips where I go back to when I was 8 or something, going to that fish and chip shop. People are genuinely there. They're not thinking about anything else. They're just living their lives and they're having some fish and chips. That, in a strange way, is living embodied and authentic. Whereas the May Day, the Maypole thing, even though it had a longer history, in the moment, it didn't feel authentic to me. It felt like people were, I don't know, doing a LARP or even worse, just kind of doing it as a bit of kind of antiquated fun. So how do you deal with this particular problem? Because it's something I've kind of meditated on, and I don't really know the answer to it.
Well, the Maypole example is kind of interesting because it feels old. It gestures toward like a deep folk custom, folk continuity going back before, you know, England ever became Christianized. And it feels like it's kind of ours. And this oursness, I actually devote a section in the book to coining this term oursness, sort of Heideggerian, that is essentially the legitimating factor. It's sort of the core of legitimacy. But for most people today, it doesn't have the resonance that it once did, because the world that produced the Maypole has in some sense disappeared. Now, I, as a pagan revivalist, am keen to revive that world, or at least to revive the substrate that sort of like underlies it. But it's important, I think, what you're sort of getting at here is that symbols can't carry a civilization if the forms of life that produce those symbols have disappeared, right? And this is why restoration, and I use that term very deliberately here, why restoring the nation is such a serious task, because the Maypole is not at all meaningless. It's very meaningful. It's tied to us as a people. It's something that no other people has produced. And it's the same reason why we need to restore and perhaps undo some of the precedent that has been accreted into the English Constitution, obviously an unwritten constitution based on precedent. Well, there have been some horrific precedents that have been established in the last few generations. So we need to restore that. So this kind of what you're gesturing at, I think, is that this form of life doesn't feel authentic because it has kind of disappeared. And the question is, can we regenerate that? Can we regenerate these thick bonds of identity? I think that we can, right? But I also understand why people say, for example, call paganism a LARP, or why they feel like it's kind of a performative thing, because rebuilding that world will take a lot of effort. Now, I don't want to get into pagan revivalism. That's not what we're here to talk about. We could just as easily, and we should be talking about reviving Britain, restoring Britain as a form of life, as what it was. And that doesn't mean that it can't continue into the future. As we said before, nations need to be living things. They need to be dynamic. They're not fossils. But we do need to restore it because it's not healthy. There's nothing bad about going backwards. There's nothing bad inherently about restoring health with sickness. If you have cancer, you want to restore your earlier state, and there's nothing wrong with that. And that's kind of what I think, you know, folks who are organizing these Maypole celebrations, they in their own way are trying to restore Britain. They're trying to restore their English and British identity by reviving these folk customs. So I think that that's actually very important work that they're doing, but it's just simply not accomplished yet. And that is why it feels a little bit inauthentic. But as my boy Dave says, once like something might be a LARP, but then once you teach it to your children, it becomes tradition. And this is you know, really important for us to understand that once we win, and we will win, whether it depend, the only question is at what cost? Will we restore Britain, or will we restore a patchwork of tribes? But when we do win, and liberalism is, you know, somewhat into the rearview mirror, these things will appear as though they are forever, like that they've been there forever to our children, in just the same way that fish and chips feels like it's been there since we were speaking old English, right? So this is the work that we have to do, basically. And it just seems that it's not done yet.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, obviously, I had the desire to do the Maypole, and I think I'm going to try to do it every year so that it does become something that at least my six-year-old daughter becomes accustomed to doing every single year. You know, and maybe by like the fifth year, it won't feel like a LARP or whatnot, you know. But last thing I want to touch on, Mike, before we go, is that one of the reasons I've never called myself a nationalist is because I've, you know, from a pure realist point of view, I've never really been convinced that lots of nations kind of have the capacity, like whether it's realistic for them to assert their nationalism. Right, let's put it that way. And I'm pretty sure that you and I discussed this, you know, in one of our previous conversations. You know, so when I look at, for example, you know, Russia versus Ukraine, I see a massive empire versus one tiny little, well, it's not tiny, but one relatively small nation. And, you know, for a lot of people, they think like, well, okay, because I'm a nationalist, I support Ukraine in that. Whereas me, as the kind of slightly colder realist, just says, no, the empire is always going to assert itself, and the history of mankind is the history of empires. But apart from the American Empire, which we need to park for a second, which I see as uniquely evil, and I'll explain why in a second, I think that these two things that we've been talking about, the overarching empire, okay, and these little local identities, can and have for hundreds of years coexisted. That is, the imperial center, if it's wise, if it is judicious, and if it is, you know, done in the best possible way, actually leaves these little things alone and is happy just to collect a couple of taxes from the local leaders and to devolve the power downwards. And all the most successful empires in history have done this. Persian Empire, Ottoman Empire, British Empire to some extent did this, although it did crack down on, you know, burning widows in India and things like that. In many other respects, it left a lot of places to kind of get on with it. You know, it didn't meddle. You know, even the Roman Empire, you know, didn't actually leave a kind of, yeah, okay, they may have built some roads and put in some administration and so on, but in terms of the actual local customs, they didn't trample on them in the way that, let's say, Napoleon did in France, as we were talking about earlier on. So I've always thought that the ideal scenario would actually just be to, I don't know, allow the play of the great powers, as Mia Shoma talks about, to play out, but to hope that they are wise enough to kind of allow the local to flourish and to be, you know, relatively unmolested. My problem with the American Empire, and we do have to talk about this because we've all lived under it for our entire lives, is that the American Empire feels like it wants to destroy all locality, all quality, all manifestation, and turn it into a theme park version of itself. In a way that I find uniquely destructive. It is the, you know, when Ebola talks about it as the anti-modernity, as the anti-tradition, right? What he's talking about is its capacity just to basically raise and eradicate and homogenize all in its path. And this I find, you know, when I go around this country, the thing that depresses me most, not just around this country, but around the world, is if I go to a city or if I go to a town and I feel like it could just be any other town, you know, and, you know, I don't want to go to like Birmingham and be like, well, this literally could be anywhere in the country, because most high streets now are exactly the same with the same shops, the same malls. You know, you stand, there's a place down the road from here called Woking with this enormous shopping mall. Could be literally anywhere in the country. You just wouldn't know where you were. Could, and you could even lift it up and, you know, other than the spellings of a few things, you could probably be somewhere in the Midwest, because these things exist all over America as well. And I'm sure they exist in Australia and in Canada as well. So this to me is one of the biggest challenges. And I would love the American empire to kind of not be like this, to kind of allow the local to flourish a bit more under its hateful gaze. So what do you say about this?
I would love to see that as well, because it seems that that is, for better or worse, what we live under right now. We live under that empire. And there are historical precedents for it being able to work. I mean, the Persian Empire was a really good example of being able to tolerate local difference. Even the Mongols, for the relatively brief period of time that they had their empire, they were quite religiously tolerant. You know, you think of something like Christendom in the Middle Ages that sort of left local parishes and villages and local lords and kingdoms more or less to sort of tend to their own, you know, affairs and everything like that. Rome, to some extent, the British Empire, to some extent, China, you know, there's all, like, you know, historically China was able to do that within its own ambit. So it's not like this is impossible, but I think that the issue is that the logic of power and the structure of imperialism sort of dictates that it will always go in the wrong direction, right? Because empire will tolerate local identity only so long as it remains politically weak. And it will remain politically weak only so long as it's not thick, right? So the American empire, or the quote-unquote international community, as it's sometimes called, it kind of speaks in this language of universality, but the universality requires that it weakens these local and particular loyalties that are stubborn and won't sort of play ball and everything like that. And, you know, it basically does this by undermining the social capital and the pre-political identities that the larger identity relies upon. So all that's kind of left to bind people together is coercion and naked force, because geopolitical scale has to tend toward abstraction. Like the global empire, or the global American empire, or whatever you want to call it, it requires a level of standardization and ideological simplification and all of this stuff that is just totally disconnected from real life. So empire in general, like historically, empire begins as tolerant, but then it tends to kind of unravel peoplehoods over time, because then people get used to living under it and, you know, no longer are they grateful that the emperor is letting them have the religion that they want, but they actually get ambitions and they want to sort of break away, or they want to, you know, angle for more power. So it tends to, like, empire basically has to tamp down on these local identities. It can tolerate them sort of, but it can't really allow them to get too powerful. So it over time, empire tends to erase these more local identities. And that's what's happening now. And I think that the American empire has now reached a point where it's so coercive, where it's so badly undermines the local identities, that it effectively has turned almost all of its vassal states against it. And this is why you see, like, a true revival happening in Britain rather than happening in America, right? Donald Trump, I mean, yes, Trump at one point did represent like a serious challenge to the system. Obviously, he's been folded into it now, but this is always what happens in at the late stages of empire, which is that the provinces or the outlying areas, this is where trouble starts. And trouble for the American Empire looks like Rupert Lowe. Trouble for the American Empire looks like all of the, like, you know, it looks like the March for Australia and so on and so forth. All of these things spell the end of it, basically. And it, the only thing that it can do, basically, is to become more coercive, and that makes things worse. It just starts a feedback loop that essentially leads to imperial unraveling. So unfortunately, that's what's happening, but also in a way, fortunately, that seems to be what's happening. I just don't see a future for Tony Blair, unfortunately for him. He's had his golden age, I think. So for me, that is a white pill, but I guess it depends on your perspective.
I tend to agree, Mike, to be honest. I feel like something's happening. I feel like it is unraveling faster than any of us would have thought a few years ago. And, you know, I get the sense that people are ready for some, like, people in general, it's not just political anger anymore. They're ready for something else as well, I think. But I could be wrong. Anyway, Mike, what is the name of the book again, and where can people get it?
It's called Nationalism, and it's part of our new Fundamentals series. And you can pick that up at imperiumpress.org. So check that out. We've been very busy this year. We've got already dozens of books out. So I hope you guys enjoy all that.
Fantastic. And you want to keep Imperium Press busy, guys, because they're one of the few genuinely quality presses out there, you know, publishing material like this. So yeah, do support them as much as you can. Also, you can pick up, of course, the Academic Agency promo code COOL, and I'll catch you all next time. Cheers, Mike. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.